This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamoto, MPR.
Kia ora and welcome to Reserved Recommendations. This is a show about great trash, difficult art, and our complicated relationships with art and culture. My name's Hugh, I'm the host of the show, and I'd like to take this opportunity to put in a very mild content warning for the show as a whole. Sometimes our recommendations on this show are reserved just because the thing that we're discussing is in some way not good, but sometimes there are aspects of the art or artist that may be confronting for some people. Check the episode descriptions for more information, and do be aware of your listening environment. This is another episode of Reserved Recommendations. This is a radio show and podcast about great trash and difficult art. And today I'm talking to Mike Sands. How's it going?
It's good. Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, well, thank you for coming. The thing that you wanted to talk about, and the reason that I'm kind of launching straight into it, is I think we might need to do a little bit of kind of setting the table for people, maybe, is you were talking about like role-playing games with really unique mechanics. And I think that's a really interesting thing to talk about. But like when we say unique mechanics, we're kind of, the question is kind of like relative to what? And if people are not necessarily familiar with tabletop role-playing as a field at all, like how would you set that table there?
Like what the default is that
yeah, I guess so. Like what do you feel like it's a, I don't know, necessarily a reaction against, but something like that?
Well, I guess you can go back to like Dungeons and Dragons, which was the first role-playing game from back in the 1970s, where you had one person who was acting as a kind of referee and creator who built this world that everyone else got to explore. And they'd have characters with various numbers attached to what they could do. And, you know, when it was in question, can you do this thing or not? You'd roll a dice and see if you were good enough or not. With a kind of general, like they were, and it was a fantasy game, so it was like inspired by things like Conan and Lord of the Rings and all that. So they're off having adventures, fighting monsters, stealing treasure and all that sort of thing. And trying to overcome challenges was quite a big deal back then, as well as like exploring the story side of it and being great heroes and on the adventure too. So I feel like that's kind of like the starting point for it all.
Yeah, yeah. And there was, I guess you would call it like a counter wave in some ways in the, I feel like it was through the late 80s and the 90s where there was a shift towards maybe at least on the cover of the book, the idea is that we're going to tell grand stories. But there was still a real focus on, I guess you would call it like a generalist approach. So the idea is that if you think about something like Vampire the Masquerade, any given vampire, you can go, okay, well, I know how they're going to be able to do it, basically any task, because there's a skill for each task. You know, like it's not set out for like a narrow genre emulation kind of thing. It's like we could be asking people to face any sort of challenge.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. And as you say, like through the late 1980s and the 1990s, there were a lot of games like that that had like all these ambitions for doing something quite different, and yet still had like systems that replicated that, you know, here's a list of all the things and how good you are at them that you'd use to resolve everything that came up.
Which, I mean, amongst other things, means that like with the amount of just sticking with Vampire, because World of Darkness is probably the non-Dungeons and Dragons thing that I know best. The amount of points that you get to buy competency and skills, and how many points you need to spend to be like effective at anything, means that like a huge amount of your
character sheet in Vampire the Masquerade is unused real estate. You know, like, if you try and put 2 points into everything, then you're going to spend a lot of time having a really, you know, not being able to do very much. And so in practice, you've got all of these things you could do, and you're probably going to want to do five of them.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not the only game like that. I'm thinking, too, of games like Call of Cthulhu, which is a kind of cosmic horror game, or RuneQuest, which both are based on the same kind of system and, like, have, like, a page full listing of all the different skills that your particular character doesn't care about most of.
And so I guess there's, like, I don't know if you would necessarily call it a third wave, because I don't know that you would necessarily count them like that. This is the point at which my precise chronology gets foggy, but there's the whole field of things influenced by Apocalypse World, all of the powered by the Apocalypse things.
Yeah, I think they are I think they are like a third wave of designs. And I think kind of from the very late 1990s and the early 2000s, I think there was a large number of game designers who were looking at those ones we were just talking about, things like Vampire the Masquerade, and seeing, look, it says it's got all these ambitions to be this super melodramatic kind of horror story, you know, and all the things it wants to, but the game systems don't quite make that happen. So I think that in that time there was a build of, let's try and find systems that do provide the experience they say they're going to. And I think Apocalypse World might be like towards the tail end of that. I think there were a lot of designs trying that before it came out.
I was going to say, it's the one that's definitely stuck, though, right?
Yeah. Well, I think maybe a lot of the lessons from the people experimenting, I think maybe the bakers kind of managed to figure all that stuff out and distill it into a really nice package in that game, which is not to kind of be down on them for their work, because I think it's a great game which does a lot of cool stuff. It kind of feels more like the culmination of that movement rather than like a pioneer. You see what I mean?
And I guess if I was to summarize that right down, the powered by the Apocalypse thing, it would be you get a playbook, which is like it's almost like a character class, but it's a little bit more evocative and open-ended. And within your playbook, you get just the five things that you care about. You know, and you don't worry too much about like having a space for algebra or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's another side to it as well, where that design approach means that the rest of the game is only there to support that what you're trying to play. And in the case of Apocalypse World, it's kind of Mad Max style action and intention, and like kind of everything in the game is only there if it helps get that feel across, and anything extraneous, like you're saying, how good you are at algebra, that's just left out.
Yeah, and I guess that's what made it so endlessly hackable as well, is because you can go, okay, well, instead of Mad Max, maybe we do hard-boiled detective stories or
Monster of the Week shows.
Exactly, and to talk about the one that you had some personal input into. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You can go, well, you know, let's not worry about desert supercars. We'll worry about how good you are at flying spaceships or whatever the thing is.
Absolutely. And I think that's, you know, as you say, there's been a whole range of games based on that system and that kind of approach, and they've been very successful. So there's obviously something in it.
I mean, to the point where it's, and this might be my kind of filter bubble of the sort of stuff that I'm interested in, but it seems to be like kind of edging out D20, as like there was a period where there was a D20, which is like Dungeons and Dragons with all of the Dungeons and Dragons taken out, like Dungeons and Dragons stripped down to the skeleton. There was a D20, basically anything you could think of. And it seems to me now that Powered by the Apocalypse is filling that niche in a lot of ways.
I think it's definitely coming up and giving people other options, but I think that still Dungeons and Dragons, in its current incarnation, is still like most of the role-playing game hobby, because it's the one everyone, if you've heard of any role-playing games, you've heard of Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If you're going to have a bunch of scrappy kids on a TV show play a role-playing game, they're not going to play Vampire the Rat Masquerade, and they're definitely not going to play, like, Tunnels and Trolls or Traveller.
Yeah. Or the games that I was talking to you about to talk about here tonight.
So, I mean, to get onto those, I think we've probably done enough table setting. Like,
sure.
We've kind of talked about how By the Apocalypse gives people the tools to make things more evocative and more, I guess, cinematic. Like how
Not necessarily cinematic, but appropriate to what you're trying to do.
It's
kind of quite general a way to say it, but I think everything here is, you know, you've looked at through a lens of what kind of gameplay am I after?
Yeah, no, exactly. I think that's a really good way to think about it, is to say, like, the games we're going to talk about are games where they've gone, I'm interested in a really specific vibe, and I'm going to, like, hone right down to that. And when I say hone, like, that's sometimes that sounds like you're getting rid of things, but some of these games are quite expansive. So one of the games that I mentioned when you brought up this topic was Yazeba's Bed and Breakfast, which is this kind of ever expanding thing, because what they're trying to riff on is like an animated sitcom that you only caught a couple of episodes of when you were about 11, like old enough to have some sense that there was something more complicated going on, but not quite old enough to get it. And so they do lots of things, like there are bits of the book that you unlock by doing other bits of the book, so that by playing through episodes, essentially, you become able to do other episodes. And that's like quite alien to a kind of a straightforward like toolbox story game.
Yeah. Actually, one of the ones I was going to mention, Sundervold, has got a similar thing. That's basically, in many ways, it's kind of a pretty typical fantasy adventure story game. But what they've done is they've been inspired by legacy board games, the kind where as you play it, a story plays out and you might change the rules and change the components of the board game. And in Sundervold, what they've done is all throughout the book, they've got little sections that say, when this happens, do this. And there's places to like write your changes into the rule book. So it will kind of be permanently altered by your group's gameplay and what happened to you. Which I thought is a pretty cool variation. And what it's kind of doing is it's taking away, when we go back to that original idea of what Dungeons and Dragons was at the beginning, the fact that there's one person who's the referee and dungeon master who like decides what the world's like that you're exploring. Well, in this one, like any player could, because each of the different unlock things, it might say, when your character does this thing, you get to decide this, or the whole group does. So it kind of brings a kind of collaborative element to how it develops rather than leaving it all on one person's head, which is good.
Yeah, no, I think it is good. And I think that's like, it's not a reservation in the sense that it's a bad thing, but it does mean that there's an expectation there that I guess players are participating with some sense of how these things work, like some prior experience, or that the game is supremely confident in its own ability to onboard people, which is...
I think there's a bit of both. Like, I mean, I think you definitely have to have the buy-in from the group, and you've got to have people who want to do this sort of creation as you play. But also the way it's structured, its unlock things, is they are kind of filtered through experience. Like one of the early ones is for when you pick what kind of character you're going to be, like whether you're a knight or an explorer or whatever. There's a little box at the beginning that says, once someone has played every different kind of character, you invent a new kind. So there's kind of a natural evolution of, you know, of course, by the time everyone's tried, you've tried all of them as a group. So you're going to have a good idea what works and what doesn't.
Yeah, that idea of, so to go back to the way that games like Dungeons and Dragons and then sort of the even through into Powered by the Apocalypse stuff, actually, there's an idea that of character progression where you kind of become more powerful as a consequence of your own actions. So Dungeons and Dragons straightforwardly had like experience points. You get them for killing things and taking stuff. And when you have enough of them, you go up a level and then particular things happen and you get better at stuff. Yeah. Other games had that where you got experience for doing various other things and you could maybe spend the points on specific things, but there was this idea that like you do stuff and that gets you things. But the idea that particular kinds of progression are just triggered by stuff that happens as a consequence of having played for a certain amount of time is very interesting. One of the games that I've been looking at and I kind of want to play, but I have no idea with whom, is Wander Home, which is by the same one of the same people as is responsible for Yazeba's Bed and Breakfast. And Wander Home has a process where like you play as anthropomorphic animals going on a journey somewhere, and time passes as you do that, and every time you hit a seasonal festival, which is an amount of in-game time which is kind of up to you depending on the vibes, that causes you to have a progression within your character playbook. So just through
a lot of those are more like changes than improvements too, as I remember from reading it.
Yeah. And the end point of the track of all of those, so you don't have to do them in order, but if you were doing them in order, the last point is always something that causes your character to leave the party as well.
That's right, and kind of settle down somewhere new or something like that.
Settle down somewhere new, go off on their own adventure. There's a playbook called The Guardian where you have a ward. So you're like an older person looking after a kid, and you retire and start playing as your kid.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And the thing about that is that they've gone for this very specific, like, I relate it to a very particular, like, fictional passage. There's a bit in the first Moomin book where Moomin Troll wakes up early because Snufkin, his best friend, has whistled outside his window. And he goes down to the bridge, and Snufkin is fishing off the bridge in the dawn and tells him that, like, it's time for me to go off again. And there's, like, this real sense of, like, peace and melancholy both at once, and it's kind of astounding to me how well they nail that, at least in the text. I haven't tried doing it yet.
Yeah. To throw in a different version of that, one of the other games I was going to mention is City of Winter, from Deinacorn Games, which is, it's a sequel to another game called Fall of Magic, which I've played a few times and really love. And it's got a fantastic physical presentation, which is absolutely beautiful, was the first thing, including like a big map you unroll as you journey. But the story of this game is that you are a family of refugees fleeing from this magical threat. And all the mechanics in the game, like what you do each time it's your turn to set a scene, is you either share a family tradition with another character, or you witness either a family tradition or a new tradition of the place you're staying. And all the change of your characters as they kind of make this journey and grow older is just about which of the traditions they're remembering and have experienced. I've yet to play it, but I can see that you know, the choices you make of when you have to like abandon a tradition or pick up a new one are really going to shape the story of this family on their journey, which is another really fascinating take on it, I think.
Yeah, no, it is. And it's like the playing around with the barrier, if you like, between the character and the player, I find very interesting. Wander Home does another thing where when you introduce your character's playbook, it has questions that you ask of other players based on their physical proximity to you. So you get like two questions, one's for the person on your left and one's for the person on your right. And the reason I think that's so interesting is because like there are games going back that have messed with that sort of thing, but it's interesting to see how it's kind of getting made, I don't know, like, well, getting refined to fit the specific vibe that people are after.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I think there's always got to be an acceptance of the fact that you are playing these games as a social thing in a group, right? So, I mean, I guess in these days of pandemics and so on, we're often playing online as well. But, you know, in the traditional sense of you're sitting around a table with some friends. So, yeah, of course it makes sense to kind of draw that kind of social external thing in and use it when it can help the game do what it's trying to do.
So there's a game that I didn't really get. I kind of contemplated spending money on it and downloading it, but life became briefly too much, and so I just kind of looked at the stuff around it. But you talked a bit about this game called Mask Witches. And I've had like a look at the outside of it, and it looks fascinating. Partly
it really is.
Because of the way that it's setting out to do things, but partly also because of its kind of visual presentation. So I wonder if you could talk a bit about that one in particular.
Yeah. Okay. So the game is Mask Witches of Forgotten Doggerland. It's from Handiwork Games in the UK. And the idea is that you're like these psychedelic witches in the Stone Age in what's now the North Sea, protecting your communities from evil spirits. And the amazing art is from, I think, John Hodgson, who also wrote the game, who's an artist, playing around with some of the art production tools, like Midjourney and things, I think. So he was like trying to use those as a tool to get some really weird images out to fit his idea of these witches, which I think he's done a fantastic job of. The game itself is like, it's in many ways, it's super simple. I think you basically define your witch by one or two things you're good at and bad at. And if you face an obstacle and it hits one of those things you're good or bad at, you roll a single normal six-sided dice. If it's something you're good at, you fail on a one. And if it's something you're bad at, you succeed on a six. And that's pretty much it. So the story's going to be very much of kind of telling the story of what happens with just a super simple way to resolve, you know, when you come up against a difficulty fighting these spirits, how it goes. And there's some kind of strange aspects to it which fit in with how your characters change, because one of the things that can happen is, like, due to your adventures and things, bad things happen to you, you could become bad at other things. And each bad thing in the game, you have an amulet that represents it. So as your witch gathers these amulets of things that they're bad at, they're kind of increasing those, you know, the number of those. But those can also be used to fight spirits. So they're both good and bad. And the other one is when you discover new things you're good at, those are represented by your masks. But one of the things is, of course, a mask can be shared. You could give it to a different witch for them to use. So you can kind of give away a thing you're good at to one of the other characters, which I think is lovely.
And yeah, it is. And because you're dealing in this sort of Stone Age psychedelia, which, I mean, part of the reason that I find this so interesting is that one of my big like hooks that gets me interested in things is folk horror. I really like that. Basically, I like when British people stop being white and start being British. You know, like they stop going, we have no culture and culture is only for inferior people, and instead like digging into the deeply weird stuff that's buried in the background.
And I think that's definitely what Hodgson's after here. And also there's another game in the series called The Silver Road, which is very much exactly that kind of folk horror. I think it's kind of inspired by the Brisingamen books and the Owl Service and all that sort of thing.
Yeah,
if you want children stumbling on horrors from the ancient world.
Man, I got those books because When I lived in the UK as a kid, my parents employed this lady to babysit me and my brother, and she used to work for the publisher Collins. So she would get kids' books that had like minor factory flaws very cheap. And she, I don't think she really paid any attention to what they were. And so we just got scads of books from her, which like some of them were great and some of them were not, but all of the Alan Garner stuff was just dropped on me completely without context when I was about 11.
Yeah.
Thoroughly turned my brain inside out.
Yeah, honestly, I think it did the same to me, although I think I just picked it up off a library shelf at about the same age. It's like, this looks interesting.
I do think, like, Alan Garner is probably one of these people where, like, context is best afterwards. There's something kind of primally strange about his conception of kind of the magic underneath Britain that is like, it's very powerful and very evocative. I guess the other thing I was thinking with mask witches is, of course, like wearing a mask does stuff to your identity. And so
it's definitely playing on that.
Like switching masks to have different interactions with different spirits and things gives your character a weird kind of fluidity that you often don't have in these kinds of games.
That's definitely one of the ideas I love about it. It feels like it has that sense, and it's obviously it's a made up spiritual world of the Stone Age, but it's one that feels very compelling, you know.
I mean, it's not like we have a lot of Stone Age people around to ask them about their spiritual beliefs.
No, no.
Like, you do kind of have to take your best guess, and I mean that's kind of like what Alan Garner excels at is taking guesses that are incredibly evocative in that way. Look, we are around about at the halfway mark, at the halfway mark here on NPR, we do have to quickly break for some station messages, so we're going to do that right now. We'll be back right after this.
If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. NPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out npr.nz for more information. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate. If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app.
And we're back. You're listening to Reserved Recommendations. This is a radio show and podcast about great trash and difficult art. And it is produced by Manawatu People's Radio Te Reo Irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatu with the support of New Zealand On Air. So cheers for that, guys. I'm talking to Mike Sands, who is a role-playing game designer and things, about games with unusual mechanics in the tabletop role-playing space. We've just been talking about Mask Witches and The Silver Road, which are both, like, they feel like real refinements to me of this, like, just get to the story. Tell us a story like a story is told impulse.
Definitely, yeah. And I think that, and they're very conscious of the stories they're trying to tell and what the minimum to get away with telling those stories is.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, impulse to shed dead weight is really valuable.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. It's, well, I mean, as you just mentioned, I am a game designer, and I find one of the toughest parts of that is chopping off bits of design that don't belong there. It's easier to kind of add extraneous stuff than it is to kind of slim down to what's essential.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's particularly an occupational hazard, because if you're someone who designs role-playing games, then you're someone who likes role-playing games. And if you're someone who likes role-playing games who is, like, approximately our age, then you probably got into the hobby when what was on offer was, like, here are 5 pages of charts that tell you exactly yep. what your sword swing did to someone's left kidney. Like, that impulse is kind of buried somewhere, you know?
Yeah. I think it's designing in this kind of context is also something you only get started because you want to tinker with things, and that kind of just gets steadily more out of hand until it turns into a whole new thing.
Well, I mean, you know, so this is where my dirty laundry comes into play a bit, I suppose, is that I used to run very odd games for tournaments in Dunedin and occasionally up in Wellington at Capcon. And the impetus behind those was usually just, like, either being annoyed at something or one wild idea, you know? And then seeing how far you could push it. So, I mean, the discipline of tinkering is something that I really respect.
Well, they're not really exclusive. I think you can end up going to the crazy ideas from tinkering too.
Yeah, yeah. One thing that happened was that I think it was, like, promotion for a pub or a nightclub or something. It was something quite boring. Maybe it was a TV show. I don't know. But what we ended up making, my brother and I, was this. The concept was that you woke up in various situations, and the phrase "you have 24 hours" was painted in some sort of fluid on a surface that you could see. And you would wake up next to a notebook, which you physically had on the table, which said "take notes." The concept was that every time that you ran out of the 24 hours or somebody died, everyone passed their character to the left and the entire situation started again from the beginning. But that was on the basis of someone stickered the whole of Dunedin with all of these stickers that said "you have 48 hours. And I no idea what it was about, but I just found that, like, this idea. Message being everywhere was, like, really powerful. I mean, I don't know that in practice it was necessarily good, but it was interesting.
Well, I think with all of these things, I mean, you can't really control where the inspiration comes from.
No, and I mean, I guess, like, with music, I suppose, the ability to just do something and put it in the world and get feedback for it is more ever present than it ever was, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So one of the reasons that we're having this conversation is that we're coming up on a big event for Kiwi RPG, which I want to kind of plug in passing, because I don't know that people would necessarily think of New Zealand as a hotbed for role-playing game design, but there's lots of fascinating stuff going on. Like, are you doing anything cool for that?
I'm not this year. I don't have too much on for it. But there is definitely a lot of stuff coming out. There's to introduce it to people, there is a little kind of cooperative group that recently got set up called Kiwi RPG, and this publicity week's one of the things we're doing to kind of raise the knowledge of it. So there are a bunch of people involved in that who are releasing new games and bits and pieces for it. There are a bunch of people who are going to put their games on special. There is a bunch of streams and other events like that happening. So there is a lot going on, and anyone who finds any of that even remotely interesting should go and check out kiwirpg.com, which will have a list of all the stuff that's going on the week, which the dates suddenly have gone out of my mind. Is it the 10th to the 18th, I think, of June?
Right, so that's coming up pretty soon. Like, this is sort of sideways of the unique mechanics thing, but one of the things that I, because I'm sort of looped into the community loosely through past good behavior more than anything, or bad behavior more than anything else. But as a consequence, I follow a few people who are related to it on Twitter and various platforms. And one of the things that's been really interesting is that it's provided, like, almost like an official spot for New Zealand, and particularly like Māori commentary on stuff that's happening in the gaming world.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that I didn't have much for part of this except being part of some of the meetings that decided it, but one of the objectives of the group is to kind of provide a place where we can comment on things like from a New Zealand or Aotearoa perspective. And that has come up in a couple of places with things like appropriation of Maori art and the Kiwi RPG community. One of the jobs we've taken on ourselves is to comment on these things when we see them happening out in the world. But more generally, it's primarily there as a kind of cooperative way for those of us who are involved either in game design or content creation with role-playing related media to like get in touch with each other and share what we've learned and what we know, which so far it seems to be doing really well. You know, I've been doing this for a little while and knew a few of the other people, particularly those in Wellington where I live, who are working in the same area. But since the group's kind of become official and started publicizing ourselves, we've got a whole lot of people coming in and joining who I had no idea were out there. So that's fantastic, just seeing how many people are doing this kind of stuff here.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, to come back to the, like the unique games thing, I think it's amazing how many people like have that really specific vision, or they've come across something that's really specific in that way, to having that really niche appeal, and it's set them off on a path, you know?
Yeah. No, there's a lot of that kind of design going on, and it's really great to see. I love it.
yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I've always like felt is that there is a very particular vibe. I feel it particularly in Wellington and Dunedin, of like something that started out with a particular kind of colonial grandeur and has now turned into something else. I feel like that spirit could be channeled in very evocative ways if people kind of worked it out. I guess I'm thinking about like specific New Zealand lenses that people might bring to this hobby.
Yeah,
you know?
I've definitely seen a few people who are working on things that definitely have a strong feeling of coming from here. I don't think very many of them are kind of published or ready for anyone to take a look at yet, but there's definitely a lot of cool stuff in the works anyway. So yeah, and hopefully that we'll see more of that as kind of it becomes hopefully a stronger community, and indeed for the people who are not part of it even, because, you know, there's plenty of other people playing and designing role-playing games out there in New Zealand who haven't come across it yet, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, everyone's, you know, my day job is around helping people make content and looking at the general podcasting space and the, like, proliferation of Let's Play Dungeons and Dragons podcasts within New Zealand is kind of astonishing. Like, there are some who are tied into the Kiwi RPG group. Morgan Davey, who's a past guest, if you would like to go back into the YouTube archives, you can find him talking about the movie Under the Skin. But he's done some kind of specifically comedic Dungeons and Dragons stuff, but like there's a huge amount of it that's kind of not even connected to anything.
I was actually invited to be a guest on Dice Legends the other week, which is another one based down in Christchurch. That was good fun to take part in and join there. Kind of weird marathon streaming day, I think was for one of their anniversaries.
Now, a thought just occurred to me, which is, are you familiar, thinking of like unique mechanics, but also like further media expansion sideways, are you familiar very much with Die?
Yes, I am. Yeah. I've both read the graphic novels and I'm looking forward to the delivery of the game when it finally gets here.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. So for people who have no idea what I'm talking about, there is a graphic novel series called Die, which is about a group of people who are brought back together by their high school dungeon master who says, I've got something special. And they've all kind of gone off and lived their own lives and become like not great and not very happy people. And the dungeon master hands them each a magic dice, at which point they are transported to the world that he came up with when he was a teenager, as far as they know. And they all have to kind of play as their classes to try and figure out what's going on and get home. And it is,
and not just like fight the monsters of this fantasy world, but also it's very much about their personal demons from their actual lives as well.
And I'm thinking in terms of like the unique game mechanics, the way in which all of the classes are these very evocative and difficult things, you know, like, rather than give people like, you're a rogue, you're a barbarian, you're a fighter, you're a wizard, you can be, you are an emotion knight. When you feel a particular emotion strongly enough, it will charge your magic weapon and you will become unstoppable.
And not just that, but like each of the classes you can be is like very, very different to each other. Because if you look at something like the current version of Dungeons and Dragons, you know, there are a lot of different kinds of character classes you can be. But in many ways, like, all their different abilities are often doing the same thing, just in different ways. Like, it's whether you hit someone with a sword to kill them or blow them up with a spell. You know, the mechanisms are much the same.
And Dungeons and Dragons, it bears repeating, has its roots in wargaming, and so in like small party tactical wargaming, and so its philosophy is very much about like how do you build a functional team as well. Like, you have a healer and a damage at a distance and a person who can do cool magic stuff in case you need it, and a hit guys with sticks guy. And the classes, and they're called paragons in Die, are much less, they're much more specific and less built around a team dynamic than that as well.
Well, actually, your phrasing in the previous bit about Dungeons and Dragons made me think that in Die, you're supposed to be a dysfunctional team. that's very much the vibe I got from reading through the preview.
Because the thing that they've now done is that they've now created the actual role-playing game as well. So you can play the role-playing game about being a person trapped as your role-playing character in a role-playing world.
Yeah, yeah. I particularly liked that one of the bonuses for the initial version of the game is even the special magic dice to transport you to the world. They've got some really fancy ones to fit that role.
It's really cool. It's really, really cool. And I've seen a little bit of the demo of it as well. And my, like, the thing that I found, or that I imagined being really powerful, is that people familiar with role-playing games will know that there are a whole bunch of different shaped dice with different numbers of sides than the standard six. And in die, there's one of each of those, and it is yours. Yeah. If you are the person who has a six-sided dice, it is the only one in the game, and it is yours.
Yeah. There's some fun little bits, too, about how you pick one. Like, I think it is the character who gets the six-sided die, I think. Are they the fool? Your special one's got to be, like, the worst, crappiest, most broken one you can find.
My nerd bona fides are such that I know exactly which one that is as well. I've got this wooden six-sided dice that came from a board game when I was like 8.
So pretty beaten up by now.
It's pretty beaten up, and the gimmick, it was one of these like big plastic gimmick board games, and the gimmick was that there was a clockwork dinosaur that you set loose on the board to knock people's tokens out of place, and so the six on the dice is a dinosaur that summons the dinosaur.
Okay. Even better.
Mm. All right, well, thank you very much for talking today, Mike. This has been a lot of fun. We've kind of done a like rapid run through a lot of different games and game systems that we've mentioned. Are there ones in particular that you would really suggest that people check out?
It kind of depends on I think there's a couple of different ways to recommend it. Like, mm-hmm. for someone who hasn't really done any role-playing games before and is interested in doing something interesting, I would say something like Wander Home that you mentioned, because mm-hmm. that's kind of got a like Studio Ghibli feel that I think most people will be able to relate to. Or maybe something, another one I've got a lot of fun out of recently is the Alien role-playing game, which is another game that's very strongly focused on exactly that thing. So if you're a fan of the Alien movies, that's a great one. Now, if it's someone who has done role-playing games and has played Dungeons & Dragons and maybe something like Call of Cthulhu or Vampire the Masquerade or those sorts of things, and is looking for some different ideas, I'd suggest maybe Ironsworn is a pretty cool one, or its science fiction version, Starforged, which are sort of derived from Apocalypse World, but they're also built so that you can do solo or cooperative play without a game master creating the world for you. And they've got quite a lot of cool ideas in there for those. Maybe one of the Forged in the Dark games, the original one that started those off is one called Blades in the Dark, which is kind of a weird industrial fantasy in which you are criminal gangs in this horrible city fighting for your place. It's kind of a bit reminiscent of the old computer game Dishonored, if anyone's familiar with that. So
the thing that I like about, because I've heard a couple of actual play things of Forged in the Dark stuff, and the thing that I find very compelling about it is that it has the idea of like building yourself up as an organization as core to it. So the idea is you kind of build your secret base and your gang and your lackeys and your stash.
That's right. Stuff. As well as having like a sheet tracking your individual character, your member of the gang, there's also a sheet for the gang as a whole, which develops. And And, you know, your gang member might get killed and replaced or go to prison or all that sort of thing, but the gang could still kind of carry on, which is really quite neat. And that's kind of followed through in most of the other games and using that engine, which there are a number of other good ones as well. There's one called Scum and Villainy, which is kind of a space opera one, where instead of a gang, there's a separate sheet that tracks your spaceship. So it's like Firefly or the Millennium Falcon or something like that. And like what your ship is will determine like what sorts of adventures you go on and what things you're good at doing. So yeah, there's lots of cool stuff in those.
Yeah, I would add as well, if you like the idea of the kind of Studio Ghibli warm, comfy vibe, definitely check out Yazeba's Bed and Breakfast as well.
Yeah,
it's
got a very similar vibe, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And the thing that they do with that is that there are, if you're not super keen on the idea of coming up with a character out of your head, because Yazeba's Bed and Breakfast is a cartoon sitcom, it has a collection of characters that exist in the show.
Yep.
Finger quotes, the show. And so, like, everyone takes turns playing one of those. The idea is that you will pass them around from session to session, and they have, like, recurring bits and plots, and there's an evil skeleton lives in the attic and wants to end the world. But anyone can reset his track that ends the world at any time for any reason. So he's like the perpetually frustrated cartoon villain. You can be that guy.
Excellent.
All of that stuff. That's there's a lot of kind of onboarding, I would say, in terms of getting you on the same page with that. Finally, plug your things. What things do you have to plug? We've mentioned KiwiRPG.com, so people should go check that out. But your individual things?
Yeah, well, my main thing is the game Monster of the Week that we mentioned in passing, which is a derivative of Apocalypse World, and it's all about being modern monster hunters, doing that Monster of the Week show sort of thing, like Supernatural and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So, if that sounds good, go find that. We've recently just done a crowdfunding for a new book to go with that too, called The Codex of Worlds, which is all about taking it away from the modern world and giving you like fantasy versions of the thing, or Victorian Gothic styles. So that's been pretty exciting. To find out more about that, you can go to my website, which is genericgames.co.nz, or my publishing partners, Evil Hat Productions, who actually print and distribute the books.
Excellent. Well, thank you very, very much for talking today, Mike.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been good fun.
You've been listening to Reserved Recommendations, a radio show and podcast from Manawatu People's Radio, Te Reo Irirangi o Ngā Tangata o Manawatu. The show was produced and presented by me, Hugh Dingwall, and I also composed our theme music. It's called Sack Jazz, and you can find it at wolfboy.bandcamp.com. If you enjoyed this show, why not go ahead and share it with a friend? You can find the last 10 episodes at npr.nz/show/reserved, or wherever else you get your podcasts. If you want an episode older than that, try searching for Reserved Recommendations on YouTube. You can find me on Twitter at Objective Realty, or you can follow the show on Facebook. And finally, Manawatu People's Radio is a non-profit community access station. If you like this or any other piece of their fine audio programming, why not fling them a dollar or two? You can go to npr.nz/donate for more information on how to do that.